Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the IBI Group fourth quarter and year-end 2019 results conference call. Please note that IBI's complete financial statements and management's discussion and analysis for the period ended December 31st, 2019 were filed on SEDAR and have been posted on IBI's website at www.ibigroup.com. During the formal remarks, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Should you have any questions at that time, please press star followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Some of the statements made on today's call might contain forward-looking information. Listeners are cautioned not to place undue reliance on these forward-looking statements, since a number of factors could cause the actual future results to differ materially from the targets and expectations expressed. The company undertakes no obligation to update or revise any forward-looking statement, whether as a result of new information, future events, or otherwise, unless expressly required by applicable securities law. For further information on risk factors, please view the company's annual information form filed with the Canadian Securities Regulatory Authorities and available on the company's website, the SEDAR website, or by contacting IBI directly. All amounts discussed today are in Canadian dollars unless otherwise stated. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Scott Stewart, Chief Executive Officer for IBI Group. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us to review IBI's fourth quarter and year-end 2019 results, which were released yesterday afternoon. I'm here with IBI's Chief Financial Officer, Stephen Taylor. I'm very pleased to share IBI's 2019 financial and operating results, which reflect our success establishing IBI as a technology-driven design firm. We ended 2019 with strong underlying business fundamentals. We exceeded our revenue forecasts. We have a healthy balance sheet with debt reduced to the lowest level in the last 7 fiscal years. Our backlog is the biggest in our history. Our DSOs are the lowest in our industry in Canada. And we are positioned to capitalize on continuing urbanization trends that can support further increases in revenue, adjusted EBITDA, and margins. IBI's results in Q4 include the impact of writing off various small-dollar inactive contract assets, or RPA impacts, which Steve will explain further, and are not representative of our true operating performance, which remained strong during 2019. Our results excluding those impacts demonstrate the strong fundamentals and continued growth across our business, particularly in the intelligence and buildings practices. From an urban development perspective, IBI will continue expanding and adapting our service offerings for buildings and infrastructure clients by integrating our intelligence practice from the earliest planning and design stages through to asset management and optimization post-completion. With our proven capabilities in the design and execution of large-scale transportation projects, we are well positioned for a growing demand in Canada and globally. Ontario alone has announced programs of tens of billions of dollars in infrastructure investment over the next 10 years. We also have some 90-plus planning projects representing 10,000 acres of urban development. To put this in context, IBI led the planning and approvals process for the development of the CN Lands and Liberty Village, which led to multiple years of follow-on work for engineering and architectural services. IBI's building sector continues to be robust with a strong pipeline of committed and new work. In addition to our strong Living Plus pipeline, we are seeing growth in other areas, including seniors living and student residents. One of the important trends in the Living Plus sector is the increased demand for rental apartment developments and intensification of large-scale retail sites. We have numerous feasibility studies underway for large mixed-use developments across the Greater Toronto Area, which will inevitably lead to multi-building developments. Oxford Properties recently announced that it will be developing the largest mixed-use project in Canadian history in Mississauga. IBI are the architects of the first 5 towers on this landmark development. Also for Oxford, our corporate interior design group was invited to participate in the Workplace Innovation Challenge, designing a unique space for technology startups. Additionally, our client, Cartera, announced that Google has leased its 400,000 square foot IBI-designed office building in Toronto's financial district, which further speaks to our leadership in innovative workplace design. In the U.S. East, we are working on a master planning commission for a large residential development in the Washington, D.C. area. We are also advancing construction drawings on the Hope Point Tower in Providence, Rhode Island, which is a 46-story building, which will be the tallest building in the state. In Q4, IBI signed the Architects Declaration regarding climate and biodiversity in Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. Underscoring this commitment to sustainability, we are designing a 60-story passive house design in Vancouver for Henson Developments. This will be the tallest passive house tower in the world. Also of note, IBI did the planning approvals for the largest solar farm in Western Canada for Real Park Canada, Inc. The solar farm includes some 700,000 solar panels and can power 25,000 homes. In our infrastructure sector, we are progressing our work on the Hurontario LRT, which was announced last quarter. We are now in the detailed design phase, allowing for the start of construction in the spring of this year. The planning of this major transit infrastructure project has resulted in significant urban intensification plans in the city of Mississauga. For IBI, this includes 25 separate residential towers currently in the planning, design, or construction phase, each between 22 to 80 stories high. Our backlog in the infrastructure sector is solid, and we have achieved several small and medium-sized project wins in Q4. Other global projects continue to move forward, including the Eglinton LRT, Edmonton Valley LRT, Ottawa Confederation Line, and the Red Line LRT in Tel Aviv. We are also in the pursuit phase of several additional P3 projects in Ontario, Hawaii, California, and British Columbia. In the intelligence sector, we have a number of significant milestones in our tolling practice in Q4, including the successful deployment of the first closed tolling system in India in November 2019. This toll system included 102 toll lanes at 8 toll plazas and supports payments through cash, smart cards, and electronic toll collection. In Greece, we were awarded the Olympiodos hybrid toll collection system to be delivered this year. The project will add 30 electronic toll collection stations to the existing system, which was designed originally by IBI in 2017. We are also developing a location-based mobile app for the client, which will provide a number of interactive trip planning features to toll users. In North America, we added the toll system supply and maintenance to our existing portfolio of intelligent transportation systems work on the Gordie Howe International Bridge, which connects Windsor and Detroit. This is a landmark cross-border tolling project for the firm. We are also responsible for the overall security aspects of the major project. Additional milestones for IBI's intelligence sector in Q4 was the project management for the Metrolinx Network Operations Center. On February 15th, Metrolinx took over all rail traffic operations from CN, and IBI oversaw the successful execution of the new arrangements. The Metrolinx Network Operations Center, which became operational in November 2018, was also designed by IBI. Our work in the Network Operations Center illustrates the further integration and complementary nature of our intelligence and buildings sectors. As part of the technology pivot, we progressed our asset management product Inform on previously announced projects in India, and also implemented a solution on a 32-kilometer six-lane highway connecting Bangalore and the electronic city. The existing toll client is leveraging the platform to monitor over 1,200 assets along the highway, including toll equipment, streetlights, cameras, and other electronic equipment, providing significantly improved and more efficient oversight for ongoing maintenance. In the previous quarter, we announced two new contract wins with the states of Alaska and Wisconsin for our advanced traveler information product, Travel IQ. In Q4, we went live with both deployments, demonstrating the turnkey nature of our white-labeled solution and the speed with which we can launch our product. We are continuing development on the product, targeting the roadway networks of cities and counties across North America, ensuring our solution is more connected through shared information and data. We are also hiring more software developers and dedicated sales staff to support this initiative. We also continue to take our Travel IQ data, make it available through our API to third-party subscribers like Waze and Uber. Our acquisition of Aspire has bolstered our service offerings in the systems architecture area and given the firm a very strong pipeline of work, in particular with P3 projects in the areas of healthcare, justice, and education. Additionally, the Aspire team has secured several major commissions since joining IBI that offer the potential to double the team's existing revenue. As part of IBI's technology pivot, I'm pleased to announce that our Smart City Sandbox initiative now has dedicated physical space at IBI's head office in Toronto. The space, which was designed by our corporate interiors team, is an innovative collaborative hub to connect with clients, partners, and startups in the smart city, prop tech, and energy ecosystems. And we look forward to announcing more about the sandbox at our AGM on May 8th. I will now hand over the call to Steve Taylor, our Chief Financial Officer, who will provide an overview of IBI's financial results.
Thank you, Scott. Cash flows provided by operating activities totaled $50.1 million in 2019, an increase of $37.5 million over 2018, and totaled $32.1 million in Q4, $30.8 million higher than the same period in 2018. Due to improved collections of accounts receivable and some progress in reducing our working capital in P3 transit projects. With days sales outstanding of 64 days at the year end of 2019, IBI is leading the way in Canada when it comes to DSOs. We decreased our DSOs by 6 days relative to last year, supporting our debt reduction initiatives and demonstrating our commitment to continued improvement. We repaid $25.2 million on our bank line, and IBI has meaningfully exceeded our previous debt reduction target of $10 million for the year ended 2019. As Scott touched on earlier, IBI's reduced debt position of $77.3 million at year-end resulted in a 1.8 times net debt to adjusted EBITDA multiple, eclipsing our previously stated multiple target of between 2 and 2.5 times. This strengthened position affords greater financial flexibility and optionality for IBI to allocate capital to value enhancement opportunities like accelerated organic growth, further equity investments in early stage technologies, and corporate or asset acquisitions. Throughout 2019, IBI continued to integrate technology processes across all of our operations, including initiatives to enhance internal processes and controls within our existing ERP platform. We implemented new robotic process automations, or RPAs, in 2019 to identify and analyze a sizable number of inactive contract assets, an endeavor that would have been very onerous to do manually. These contract assets related to change orders on projects which had been recognized prior to IBI implementing our new ERP system. As a result, in Q4 2019, management wrote off various small dollar amounts, inactive contract assets, which represented a change to approximately 600 projects in total for an average of about 4,200 a project. The impact of these write-offs in total was a $1.4 million reduction in Q4 revenues and EBITDA. However, as Scott noted, the impact of these non-recurring process improvements is not reflective of IBI's underlying operations. So I'll discuss some key results, excluding the impact, to provide a better indication of our true operating performance during Q4 and the full year of 2019. 2019 net revenue of $376.9 million exceeded our forecast of $374 million, driven by growth in our intelligence and buildings practices, while Q4 net revenue was $91.7 million. Excluding the RPA impacts, our total net revenue in 2019 was $378.3 million and was $93.1 million in the quarter. Adjusted EBITDA totaled $42 million in 2019 with an 11.2% margin, and it was $6.8 million in Q4 with a 7.4% margin. Excluding the RPA impacts, adjusted EBITDA would increase to $44.6 million in 2019, representing a margin of 11.8%, and to $8.2 million in Q4 with an 8.8% margin. Contributing positively to 2019 revenue and the 2020 outlook and adjusted EBITDA outlook was IBI's 27% increase in backlog over year-end 2018, driven by particularly strong increases of 29.1% and 24.4% in the Canadian and U.S. operating segments, respectively. Our intelligence practice posted solid growth through 2019, supported by an ongoing focus on generating new recurring revenue streams that can be captured through the life cycle of assets we design. In 2019, net revenue from intelligence grew 4.5% over 2018 to $68.8 million and increased 0.5% to $17.8 million in Q4 2019 versus Q4 2018. Excluding the impacts of the RPA write-offs, intelligence net revenue in 2019 was $71.6 million, or 18.9% of total revenue, and was $18.4 million in Q4, 19.8% of total revenue. Adjusted EBITDA from intelligence was in 2019 was $10.1 million with a 14.6% margin and $2.7 million, or 15.1% margin in Q4. However, adjusted EBITDA absent any RPA impact improved to $13.2 million in 2019 with an 18.4% margin and $3.5 million in Q4 with an 18.9% margin. This clearly demonstrates the increasing contribution of our intelligence practice to IBI's corporate results. Some timing delays on projects within the U.S. segment impacted Q4 2019 net revenue of our buildings practice, which was 3% lower at $44.2 million, but the delays are expected to be reversed as contracts are signed in Q1 2020. For full year 2019, our buildings practice continued to provide growing net revenue totaling $196.7 million, 3% higher than in 2018, and generated robust adjusted EBITDA of $31.1 million with a 15.8% margin, an increase of 25% over 2018. The Q4 timing delays resulted in adjusted EBITDA for the period being volatile, totaling $2 million or a 4.5% margin compared to $4 million and an 8.7% margin in Q4 2018. Net income from operating activities increased 58% in 2019 to $22 million and decreased 40% to $2 million in Q4, which is attributable to the RPA impacts and changes in the valuation of the derivative liability on our balance sheet. Net income in 2019 totaled $16.8 million and $1.9 million in Q4. I'd like to speak briefly on COVID-19 or coronavirus. IBI has sufficient backlog of work to minimize the revenue impact for 2020. Should there be more significant economic disruption as a result of this virus, it could impact the replacement of our current backlog for 2021 and beyond, but at this point, that impact cannot be determined. We have processes in place to monitor the impact on our employees and subcontractors, and there has been no significant impact to date. IBI has implemented a plan whereby business travel is undertaken only as necessary, and we're encouraging greater use of our work-from-home policy. With that, I'll turn the call back to Scott for some closing remarks before we take questions.
Thanks, Stephen. Given continued macro trends around immigration to major Canadian cities and migration within the United States to major urban centers, we believe IBI is ideally positioned to continue generating meaningful growth. With established and proven capabilities in the development and integration of technology through our intelligence practice, we plan to continue fueling the engines of buildings and infrastructure while seeking further opportunities to develop recurring revenue streams and deliver value to our stakeholders. Looking ahead, we are forecasting total revenue of $388 million for 2020, 4% higher than 2019 revenue forecast. The company also continues to forecast that with the ongoing integration of technology, plus continued investment in innovation and software solutions, our intelligence practice is expected to trend towards the levels that represent 20% of revenue, with a 20% adjusted EBITDA margin for the end of 2020. That concludes our formal remarks. Operator, we are now ready to take questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Should you have a question, please press the star followed by the 1 on your touch-tone phone. You will hear a 3-tone prompt acknowledging your request. And if you're using a speakerphone, please lift the handset before pressing any keys. And the first question is from Michael Tupholme from TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Just a follow-up question on the RPA related write-offs. Is there any potential for further write-offs or charges as it relates to that that efficiency initiative you undertook?
Mike, thanks for the question. This was a cleanup exercise, and I'll give you a bit of background as to how the systems have been configured, so you can get some comfort on that question. Prior to the implementation of IFRS 15, there was no requirement necessary to, and you recall that happened Jan 1, 2018, for having revenue recognized in your system fully supported by written commitment from your clients. So for the last 2 years, that has changed, and we don't recognize any revenue unless we've got a signed write-off on the scope of the work and the commitment of the client to pay. Also, in our ERP system, which you know was implemented between 2015 and the middle of 2017, there were a very large number of legacy projects that have been converted over. We have been focusing in 17 and 18 on making adjustments to any remaining work in process / contract assets or accounts receivable for more of the larger projects. But when we got to the early part of last year, it became apparent that we had about 7,500 projects which were still active in our system, and we needed to set about a process where we could go back to all of the directors on those projects and confirm that the projects were closed and that as a result, any remaining assets that were sitting on the balance sheet would have to be swept into a bucket and cleaned up. So that process, the robotic process of the project close, has been running since end of July of last year. It's an ongoing process. What we've talked about in terms of the $1.4 million adjustment is just the increase in the magnitude of the adjustment over what we had been writing off before in 17 and 18. So it was a catch-up, and I don't anticipate, given that this process is ongoing, repetitive, done the same way now, that we're going to be experiencing the same thing going forward.
Okay, now that's helpful to understand all of that. You provided some detail around the impact of those charges on the intelligence practice, both from a revenue perspective and an EBITDA perspective. Is that same sort of detail in terms of reconciling what you reported versus what it would have been, excluding the impact, available for the other business practices and for your regions? Because it seems as though it affected the business right across the board.
Yeah, I can comment on certainly the two segments. The write-offs did not have significant impact at all on our buildings practice in Q4 or last year for the full year. It did. They did impact, as we talked about, the intelligence practice, and they also impacted our infrastructure practice, even to an even greater extent than the adjustments in intelligence. In terms of geographies, the two geographies that were impacted the most were the United States and our other international regions. So Canada and the UK, the impact was negligible. It was about $600,000 in Q4 in the US and about $900,000 in our other international business. So,
okay, and using the disclosure you gave us for intelligence is essentially the difference between the total impact and what you told us for intelligence. What is implied for the infrastructure business?
That's correct.
Can you talk a little bit more about the timing delays in the U.S. business as it relates to some project timing delays that you discussed? What gave rise to those delays? And you talked about those delays being resolved in Q1 2020. So just trying to understand if there's also going to be a negative impact from those delays in the first quarter, and if so, is that of a similar magnitude to what we saw in the fourth quarter?
It shouldn't occur. The delays are primarily in our, as we've talked about before, our education sector in buildings in the U.S. is a very important sector to us. As I commented before, under IFRS 15, until we get the written sign-off on contracts, we're not allowed to recognize revenue. And so we have a number of fairly significant contracts in the education sector in the U.S. where we have been given the award, but we haven't yet got the final contract. So the work has started. The clock has started in terms of getting the work done because the client wants the work done, but they're, in many cases, not so swift in terms of getting the paperwork signed. It's paperwork that has to be approved by various school board councils and that sort of thing. So it can take up to 2 to 3 months for us to get sign-off on a contract. Now, our experience has been that we always do get the sign-off, but there's a time lag in between where we have to start the work and when we can actually recognize the revenue.
Okay, so is the hope or the belief is that you'll get the sign-offs prior to the end of the first quarter and therefore you will be able to recognize the revenue for the work you've been performing in the first quarter such that there is no similar impact in the first quarter?
That is not only it's not a hope, but it is our objective to get that paperwork signed.
Okay, and then just last question on this topic. Can you provide some indication or quantification for how much of a negative impact this had on the fourth quarter for the buildings segment or buildings practice?
As I mentioned before, the EBITDA in the fourth quarter in the U.S. was down about $600,000. So the run rate that we've been running at in the U.S. for EBITDA has been between $1.5 million and $2 million a quarter. The delta between the $600,000 and that normal run rate is what the impact of the delayed contracts have been, and we fully expect to make that up. Our backlog in the U.S. is significantly higher than it has been for any of the last 3 years, and we're trending at in excess of 75% booking of capacity for the whole of 2020, which is we're very encouraged by that number.
Yes, sir, just to clarify, that the $600K that you're referring to, that is the impact of the RPA charges.
That's correct, Mike.
Okay. Last one for me. Leverage ratio has come down and is now below your target range, as you pointed out. You talked about having additional financial flexibility and optionality with respect to capital allocation, and provided some examples of the sorts of investments you could make and areas that you could pursue. What is the priority as it relates to capital allocation for 2020? What are those of those areas? Which ones do you plan on focusing on?
We've had many conversations with current investors and prospective investors in terms of where they'd like to see us going, and we're very aligned with what most of those people are saying, in that this business needs to demonstrate growth, and there are a lot of good opportunities out there for us to take cash flow and invest it in principally in technology-related companies, but it could be also other more conventional practices that help help us gain bench strength or accelerate into new markets, like the Aspire acquisition was for us. So we have an active program ongoing at the moment looking at moving forward on finding some more of those targets.
Okay, sorry, and if I could just ask one other one. The working capital, changes in non-cash working capital for 2020, how do we think about that, Steve?
Well, I think we're going to return to more of a normal pattern. As we got to a certain stage on the bigger P3 transit projects, we had a buildup of working capital. A lot of that got released in the last quarter of last year, so we saw significant cash flowing in the door. We are starting the HERE Ontario project, so there will be a build on working capital. Probably not so much this year, because the cash flows tend to be okay on those projects. In the first year of the project, it tends to catch up with you on years two and three. So in 2021, we'll probably see some more of a working capital build on the HERE Ontario project. But by and large, working capital will stay fairly constant this year. You will see us be users of cash in Q1 and Q2, just as we were last year, and catch up in Q3 and Q4, which you saw last year, and the trend, I believe, the year before. So those tend to be the patterns of working capital build and cash collection in the business.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question comes from Mona Nazar at Laurentian Bank. Please go ahead.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my questions, and also congrats on the significant debt reduction.
Thanks, Mona.
My first question, and it's not to go into the same topic, but it's more of a clarification. So if we were to strip out the non-recurring RPA adjustments, and if U.S. education contracts were signed in the quarter, then the U.S. EBITDA would have been between the $1.5 to $2 million kind of normalized level.
That is correct.
Okay, perfect. And then if I'm just looking at the significant backlog improvement on a sequential basis, I mean, 2020 guidance, you said it, that it's factoring in 4% year-over-year growth. Is it safe to assume that the majority of backlog improvement relates to projects in 2021 and beyond, or are you being conservative in your 4% growth assumption?
Well, the projects have extended over a long period of time. They're not just for 2020. We're seeing a very strong commitment and sign-up work for 2020, but they do extend well beyond 2020 into 2021.
Mona, you can see the $490 million number we're talking about. There's now no disclosure in the statements that shows which year that revenue is expected to be realized in. It's new disclosure that's required for the end of this year.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. And then just in regard to M&A targets, is your focus on the buildings or infrastructure verticals, or is it safe to assume that you continue to grow the intelligence practice organically, and is it continued smaller tuck-ins, or could we see a medium or decent-sized transaction?
A lot of it depends on what the opportunities are that are presented to us. We are, as Stephen indicated, in the market, and it varies. Certainly, we're always on the lookout for tuck-ins like Aspire and other strategic investments that are a complement to the kind of work that we do, like the investment we made in Switch, the EV charging company. The But we are also looking for complementary traditional services that are urban-focused, that are either a geographical strengthening or add new substance in terms of what's needed in urban environments. We cover transportation very nicely across the firm, and that's a key driver of urban development. But there are other key utilities, including water and energy. So those are also on our list because we see that the three prime underpinning features of urban environments is mobility, energy, and water resources and management. So those latter two become important considerations in the diversification, and then again, as I said, geographical coverage. But all with a view to that when we make those investments in what one might call more traditional A&E services, they are also an important route to market for our intelligence practice.
And so you are having discussions with targets at this point in time. Would it be safe to say that?
That's safe to say, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Frederic Bastien from Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to go back to the delays you experienced in your U.S. buildings practice. We're now more than two-thirds of the way through Q1, so I was wondering what gives you the confidence that you'll get that paperwork signed on your contracts.
Well, some of it has been resolved already, Frederick, and it continues to unfold. So I think by the time we get to March 31st, we should be in pretty good shape.
Okay, so you can confirm that some of that stuff is already taken care of.
Yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. A lot of comment on the U.S., Canadian businesses, but just wondering how your U.K. practice is doing, the other international as well. We, you know, relative to what our expectations were, you were a bit light on both on, in terms of EBITDA, so I was just wondering if you could provide a bit more color on those businesses, especially with, I guess, the environment might have changed post-Brexit, so any color would be appreciated.
Well, one thing that impacted the UK performance and lowered the margin is we had settlement on a long outstanding claim where we ended up having to pay, and that amount that we ended up having to pay in the last quarter was fairly significant, about $600,000. So Canadian. So that really brought down our operating profit performance for the year in the UK. What we are seeing in the UK is that the areas where we have been strong in past, in particular in healthcare, that the Conservative government in the UK has really started to open the purse strings somewhat and start some more cash flowing for capital projects in the UK. So, I mean, we're still very, very cautious about UK results, but we see that as opposed to last year when things were looking very uncertain, things appear to be trending in a better direction this year. Other international, on the other hand, we're strong in continue to be strong in India. We have good steady backlog of work in both Israel and Greece. Mexico looks okay. The Middle East in Dubai and Saudi Arabia, there has been a contraction in the economy in both of those economies, and so we're not seeing those two areas as being as robust going forward as they have been in the past.
Okay. I appreciate the caller. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from Maxim Sytchev from National Bank. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, Max.
Scott, just wanted to circle back onto the intelligence business. You're obviously close to the 20% target by 2020. You know, I presume obviously this business is growing at a faster pace versus the rest. So in terms of how do you think about, you know, how big can this business become over the next, let's call it, 3 to 5 years versus the rest of the company?
To answer that fully, I want to step back, and we will be doing an update on the launch of some of our new products. I would say that generally we would look to intelligence to grow in the 6 to 7% range, which is a somewhat improvement over the history. We have done business models for all of our other products. There is investment in them. Typically, it takes about 14 to 18 months to see a break even on that investment in them. So I don't see any significant acceleration that would go beyond the traditional experience in intelligence until, I would say, the first quarter of next year.
Okay, that's helpful. And then I guess the update would come around the AGM timeframe. Is that a fair assessment?
We will be. I think that's a fair assessment, yes.
Okay. And then in terms of, as obviously you're trying to push, the SaaS revenue model for some of the products that you're developing in the intelligence segment, the recurring revenue right now, is this meaningful at all for the intelligence business, or is it still very low single digits?
As a percentage of intelligence, it's not low single digits. We will be at the end of the first quarter providing detail on the ARR because we'll also have a comparison of Q1 this year and Q1 last year, and so we will have disclosure on it. But it's much more than single digits.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. And then last question. Again, given the value that is being ascribed to some of the sort of similar intelligence-type assets in the marketplace right now, any thoughts on, showing / crystallizing value in this segment? Any thoughts on that front?
Not yet. We still think it's a little too early to provide that kind of breakout and valuation. We're certainly very mindful of it internally and what we should be looking at in terms of valuations around our ARR and how that then compares to how we're then being seen in the marketplace as A&E firm only. And that certainly leads us to conclude that there's a significant opportunity for growth in the share price. And that's a large part of what's driving the whole approach to become much more of a technology-driven design firm. And the other comment I want to make on that is really important as an illustrative factor, is that the more that we have this technology in place underpinning our traditional buildings and infrastructure practice, the more we become insulated and protected against downturns. We, as an example, have deployed 5 of the 6 toll systems in Greece. We operate the clearing and settlement of the financial transactions, the electronic transactions between those toll systems. So when we had the crash in Greece, we didn't lose any revenue, and our margins were strengthened because, in fact, the cost of services then had dropped for us. That is an indicative objective of where we want to go in all of using the buildings and infrastructure routes to market so that we then become much more insulated against those kinds of downturns and then strengthens the firm with long-term relationships with the clients.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's such a obviously great capability. And then maybe just one last question. I mean, given the very strong balance sheet, any thoughts on potential buybacks given where the stock is right now?
I don't see any buybacks. I think the initiative is going to be on growth and expansion, and either by way of or combination of further investments internally, but also by way of acquisition, again, geographically and functionally.
Okay. That's it for me. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As a reminder, should you have any questions, please press star followed by one. And the next question is a follow-up from Michael Tupholm, TD Securities. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Just to clarify, Steve, the payment or settlement that was that occurred in the UK business, $600,000, was that hit the fourth quarter, or was that over different quarters in the year?
No, it hit the fourth quarter.
Okay.
And it's significantly large.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's significantly larger than due to the nature of that particular claim than we experience. Generally, our claims payment experience across IBI is very low. That one, due to circumstances, was just unusually large, and it came in Q4, and it hit the UK results.
And are there any other situations like that? I mean, I realize that to an extent that's sort of nature of the business and normal course, but as you said, that one's larger. Is there anything else like that that you're monitoring, that could come forward over the course of 2020?
Well, I think the answer is that there are always claims that are out there that we're monitoring, and I'll once again revert back to my comment about our actual amounts of payouts on those is very low. In our industry, the insurance guys we deal with generally are, there's a lot of claims and a lot of people paying out, insurance companies paying out significant dollars in this industry at the moment. So some of the others in our industry are really not popular clients with their insurance brokers. We continue to be a popular client.
Okay. And then lastly, this is probably a difficult question to answer, but with respect to COVID-19, you talk about having adequate backlog for the current year, and to the extent that there is an impact on the economy, this would probably affect the backlog and the revenue picture more in 2021. But just from the perspective of being able to carry out work, and can you just talk about the risk around that in terms of actually executing that work this year and your level of preparedness, and to what extent are people working from home at present, and anything else that you can say on that front?
We have put in place a crisis management plan that had been well developed in advance, and it deals with internal communications and actions to be taken and notifications. And we had also put in place a work from home policy and had set up the necessary, if you will, infrastructure on our IT side to support that. So we were, from that perspective, well prepared. We have, in North America, we have had in total 17 people who have been self-quarantined. Approximately 7 or 8 of those are back to work. The rest are, there's actually 2 more that are self-quarantined as of this morning. So we have in North America about 10 people. They are working from home, so we don't have any disruption there. There is an event in India where we had, in our Gurgaon office, there was an event that took place on one of the floors of our building, and as a result, the building is shut down, so all of our Gurgaon staff, or Delhi staff, are now working from home, and again, everything has been set up. It's the way we operate. As a technology company, that's the way we operate, so we can operate from anywhere, from planes and trains and homes, that's part of what defines IBI. It makes us much more resilient in terms of being able to work from anywhere. So I don't see that at the moment any of the events that we're experiencing is affecting our ability to do work.
Okay, appreciate that that color. Thank you.
Thank you. We have no further questions at this time. You may proceed.
Thank you very much. We're delighted to speak to everyone today, and we wish everybody a very good weekend. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes your conference call for today. We thank you for participating, and we ask that you please disconnect your line. Have a great day.
Well.